You're listening to Black People Go to Therapy Too, a podcast about people of color and their experiences in therapy. Don't forget to subscribe and spread the word that we're now available on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, and Spotify. Now let's begin our session. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Black People Go to Therapy 2. And unlike some of our other sessions, this will be called our first consultation. Mm-hmm. So let me explain a little bit about what that means. So, of course, in our sessions, we meet with folks who are on their mental health journeys, and we can hear about from Black and brown folks about the process to finding a therapist, the process in therapy, and a lot of the growth points and benefits they've gotten from therapy, as well as some of the challenges. But one thing that we haven't really had access to are Black and brown folks doing this work. So Black and brown mental health professionals. So that's what we hope to accomplish with our consultation episodes. And I am so excited to introduce our very first consultation with Dr. Leela Ellis-Nelson. We go way back. I'm just going to go ahead and take this moment. I imagine if people have heard us on any other things, like whether it's her coffee hour group that they have together or whether it's like other podcasts. Mm-hmm. Me and Leela go back to IKEA. We met in grad school in 2009. I didn't know her. But we had a mutual friend and was like, hey, my friend Leela's going to IKEA. She's renting a van. And I was like, oh, right. So she wasn't going with people and she was just going to get a van anyway and just be about that business. And she was. So we connected and it was just like we knew each other in another life. It was just like, you know,
talked and laughed the whole way there.
I think we went to Red Lobster, you know, which is the way that Black folks, you know, really bond, you know, over that.
If you can't connect
Bay.
Over a Cheddar Bay biscuit, then y'all not even close. Do you even know each other?
Right. But yeah, ever since then, we've been thick as thieves and we're going to continue doing work together because that's what family does. And so I'm really excited for y'all to hear all the dope shit she's been doing. So without further ado, Leela, go ahead and introduce yourself. Let us know your pronouns too.
All righty. Hey, y'all. And thanks for having me, BJ. BJ knows he's my love. I bother him every single day. My morning usually starts off with fussing at him in a text message. So he's definitely part of my morning routine and getting my shit and my life together. Well, for those of you who I haven't had an opportunity to connect with yet, my name is Leela Ellis-Nelson. Pronouns, she, her, hers. I am from Cleveland, Ohio. I was also raised in Riverdale, Georgia, like 15 minutes outside of Atlanta for anybody familiar with the area, but then back to Cleveland for eighth grade through high school, went to University of Toledo, graduated with my bachelor's in 2009, went to the Chicago school, of course, that's where I met the infamous Beach, and I graduated from there in 2015 with my doctorate after doing a year in the master's program. So yeah, that's what I've done as far as schooling, but the rest of it is the usual. I did some therapy for a little bit, realized that was not my ministry.
We don't get her back.
Never. Sometimes you just gotta let your ex be where they at. Give it back to the Lord and move on. But since then, I am now a full-time consultant through my own diversity, equity, and inclusivity firm here in Chicago. And I teach full-time at Roosevelt University, and I teach through the undergrad, master's, and PsyD program, and a few other little side projects here and there, like my couple of podcasts, Just the Thought, I Got You Pegged, and then, of course, Coffee Hour Chicago.
Yes, and so when we get to the plug segment at the end of the show, y'all, it's probably going to take about 15 minutes to hear all of the things.
It really do be a lot.
That Leela is doing. And, like, on top of that, like, a wife and a mother, And I constantly am like, how do you have time? How are you not going crazy? How are you managing all of these things? And still so willing to just like hop on and spend some time with us today to tell us again, like, what she's up to, what life being a Black mental health professional has been like. So, yeah. So you kind of mentioned, you know, you did therapy before and now you're doing more so teaching and also, you know, your company that focuses on DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion stuff. So what would you say the sort of work you do in mental health is? If you had to put like 1 to 2 words on it, what would you say it is that you do?
Honestly, I just help people figure their shit out. And a lot of that requires really them to get over their own shit, like bias, stigma, accepting and honoring stuff like discrimination, systemic oppression, and that influence on how they're able to really see themselves holistically and to feel it's all right to be their authentic selves, even if that may come with some additional stuff that requires processing down the line. But really, that was the foundation of it, is you have to get really comfortable with all of the parts of you. And a big catalyst to that is acceptance, and then honoring some of those pieces about how you have the ability to grow and change, but also just the reality that sometimes our systems don't make that easy or necessarily attainable in the way that we want. So how do we deal with that too?
Oh, and I don't have to ask this, but just for the audience, what populations do you focus on? What demographics?
See, this is where I did fuck with my mental health career heavy, because I don't know what it was, but I always just had supervisors and folks who kind of just let me do whatever I wanted to do, right? BJ can tell y'all, like when you go through your program, through your doctoral program, you do 3 practicums, which means you pretty much are free labor for 20 to 25 hours a week for whatever site you end up at. And you just do whatever they tell you to do. Then you do internship for a full year, then post-op. At each level of my career, I've been able to get the sites that I wanted to be at. So Kennedy King College, which was about, 90% Black and Hispanic, Latinx folks. So that was the majority of who I saw for my first practicum, which was all therapy, no, all testing, excuse me. And I did have 2 therapy clients. My second practicum, I was in Inglewood on the south side of Chicago. So an all Black clientele, except for 2 people who were Latinx. My third practicum was different. I was at Northwestern in Evanston. So it was a bunch of privileged white folks. And mostly my population was folks who were Asian, white, and I think that was it. That was pretty much it. And internship, I was in Bowling Green, so I had a nice little mix. A lot of my D1 football players had to see me for ALD or alcohol and other drugs counseling. And postdoc, I was at Harper. So, and then after that, I went to Roosevelt before I quit the first time and then decided to come back when I was a therapist there. So most of my clients have been Black and Latinx, predominantly Black. The majority of them have been female, femme, gender non-conforming or non-binary. And yeah, they've been all over the age spectrum. My youngest client was 3 years old and my oldest client was 72.
Dang. So you've done so much. And I feel like listening to that, people would think like, oh, this has been like the span of her whole career. But like you did all of that in such a short amount of time. Like those experiences.
Like, that's like was 5 it, like, years.
Yeah. And so that sounds like so many different populations you were able to work with. So many, you know, different marginalized identities too that you were able to work with. But I'm curious about what even like brought you to this work? What made you want to go into psychology, into that master's program, and then, you know, to get your PsyD? And that's led you to the work that you're doing now.
Yeah. So it's that cliche shit, right? It's that whole thing where you be trying to figure out what's going on with your family. So you pick a track that helps you unpack what's wrong with these Black people. You colors are acting wild out here in Cleveland. So let's figure it out. But originally, when I was 7, I told my parents I was going to be a cardiothoracic pediatric surgeon. I said that because I was an avid reader of National Geographic. And at one point, they did a spotlight about the medical field. And I was just like, ooh, I want to do this. So my dad used to have me and my sister read 20 words out of the dictionary every single week. So eventually I did learn words like cardiothoracic and pediatric. So when I realized that's what I saw in the National Geographic, I said, that's what I'm gonna do. So that's when I was 7. But then of course I get to undergrad and I failed organic chemistry. I was like, so this ain't gonna work. So we have to find something else to do. And my dad, my father, had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's during my junior year in high school. And my dad, my stepdad, has a diagnosis of PTSD because he stepped on a landmine in Vietnam and lost a leg. So he came back with a lot of that trauma. So growing up with two dads who were dealing with two very different types of mental health and physical issues led me to psychology. And yeah, I went into the master's program because no one told me I had a shitty advisor. No one told me I could have just applied straight to the doctoral program. But I'm glad because honestly, I don't know if we would have met the other way because I knew our mutual friend because we were in the master's program together. Had I been in the PsyD cohort, we would have started different. We wouldn't have even been in the same building for class. So I wouldn't have met you. So honestly, people have asked me before, has that year felt like a wasted year? I said, no, that's where I met all my best friends. What do you mean? That's where I got you. I met you. I met what Marcus, Tremaine, like everybody that is family to me now, that is my baby's aunts and uncles. I met y'all in that moment. So I don't care about the academic part. I got y'all and that was everything. And y'all were really the reason why I felt so comfortable transitioning out of therapy, because y'all are the ones who told me, or taught me at least, that it's okay to listen to that authentic stuff about you that makes you unique. And while therapy is cool and I love therapy for what it provides, it's just not me. And that's also okay. But I still love to teach. I love to support. I love to guide and I love to mentor. And diversity is at the bread and butter of my life. So that's when I said, I could be a consultant and I can teach, because if I had shitty teachers and none of them look like me, maybe I can be better for someone else.
So and also I'm happy that, you know, not enough people, not enough therapists, not enough people who get the counseling degree can admit to themselves like, yeah, this ain't really my jam no more. Like I'm not really in it for this. And if you do hear those people who are transitioning out of therapy, it's usually that they're leaving like the field of psychology altogether.
Right.
So I love that your kind of journey showed you like, hey, just because I don't want to be do counseling doesn't mean my degree was off or not. Doesn't mean that I can't still be impactful in these communities that I want to serve. I'm going to just do it by like on the fringes. I'm going to be handling all the other shit behind the scenes. And also, you didn't mention supervising. You know, you supervise clinicians too, which I imagine is really nice to have that perspective from someone of like, hey, therapy is not for me, but I still know all the benefits. And also, like, I think it allows you to really provide good feedback without having to sell, like, well, to the current therapist, like, that this has to be everything you live and breathe, because we're so much more than our careers and the work that we do too.
And I know you can attest to that. Other piece where we're taught that we also have to be self-sacrificial in that work. Because a lot of times, and we've seen this, right, in like the different Facebook groups or Twitter shit we've seen or people we talk to, they refuse to pay themselves. They refuse to take breaks. Then they wonder why they're burned out. They are prioritizing everything about their work over what their own personal needs are. And that's usually to the detriment. And like you said, they end up leaving the field. And I ain't got no qualms with the field and the work. I do have issues with our history and how we continually perpetuate bullshit standards through stuff like the DSM and not culturally competent training being infused into our programs to ensure the people working with us know how to actually do the work. But as far as the support I know it offers, it's good shit. But honestly, because I know of where we could be doing better, that's why I feel I'm a better teacher than I am in the field. Because now I get to support people who are going out there, and I get to train them to be more intentional about the work that they do. It's just that whole don't be trash model and make it the foundation of your career.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said something that like really got my mental juices flowing that I want to hear more about, but it goes in line with kind of this next question. Like why does, or what does community building within kind of like the BIPOC diaspora, like what does that look like within mental health? What are ways that we can, whether in this field or outside of this field, be contributing to, you know, letting our community know that this is out there, or not so much that this is out there because we're aware of that, but that it's accessible to us and that we're deserving of it and that, you know, yeah, we deserve to benefit from this.
I would say we have to get to a place where we feel we can trust it though first. Mm-hmm. So, and that means the field itself as psychology, if you want to make it its own little entity or whatever, it needs to prove itself trustworthy on a consistent basis. We just sent out a statement, and I'm using the royal we, right? Because I have to assume my part in the work that we do, even though all the work we do ain't part of what I'm about. So there was a statement sent down in September or December of 2020 acknowledging the American Psychological Association's role in systemic oppression and racism. The American Psychiatric Association sent out a similar letter in January. That letter got a lot of traction, but a lot of people didn't hear about the one through the APA, but also people conflate both APAs. They just think that they're the same, or psychiatric is over psychological, but that's beside the point. To me, that felt performative on both ends. Mm-hmm. It's cute that you want to put out a little, oop, my bad, sorry about Tuskegee, oop, sorry about Drapetomania, oop, sorry about DSM, oop, sorry about this, sorry about X, Y, and Z. However, we have to get to a point where we're actually in the communities working to get to know people in the same way. Honestly, I feel the same way about psychology that I do about policing. If you genuinely care about these communities of folks, but I don't see you actually with boots on the ground, getting to know people through volunteerism, through service, through support, through ensuring they have resources available to them that are accessible, that are free, that actually have people that look like them from their communities actually doing that work, then it's all bullshit. So I think when we talk about community building, the field has to get to that place.
Yeah.
And then we as individual practitioners also have to recognize the value of cultural humility and sensitivity. We have to be willing to do that work and settle in and understand our biases, our prejudices, how we may be discriminatory, racist, transphobic, homophobic, all of that shit, and actually cope in a tone. And then it's still up to the populace to decide if that's good enough for them to move forward with us too. We don't get to tell people, we said, I'm sorry, so get over yourself. So that's a big piece of it. You have to deal with your own shit, but your programs need to hold you to that fire. I don't feel like programs do that. You get what? How many diversity classes did we have in the master's program?
Just one. And that was one where I was told that, like, because of the way that I came off, that, like, is my Black experience the true Black experience? And also, like, on the other hand, I was the only Black man in the class, or only Black person in the class.
In the program, so, weren't you? No, you had Marcus and...
Yep. I had some people, but like in this class, in my diversity class, was which was you. Also like taught by an Asian American woman, like would either double down on like, oh, we're talking about something that's Black, BJ, do you have advice?
Oh, but Lord, also at times,
but also at times minimizing my experience because I let the class know, like I came from Southern Illinois, like a majority of Black people I know are just family and my town is like very, very white. But so once I gave that nugget, it was like, oh, well, you don't know about the Black experience. So like, we won't refer to you anymore. I will just go based off of what I know about the Black experience.
Jesus fucking Christ. And that's the problem, right? Because I know you, and for other folks who know BJ, you know BJ will is a strong advocate, not only for other people, but for himself. He very intentionally and clearly articulates his points and how they even connect to larger themes. And he does have a unique perspective that really gives him a sense of agency in a lot of these rooms and spaces. And that's one of the things I've always loved and enjoyed about you as a person, even besides being family or whatever. So knowing that that's your experience and you have that about you, there are a lot of people who aren't like us. And I say us because, you know, we the honey badgers that don't care, because I'll argue with you all day. I be looking for a fight sometimes. Like, fight me, bitch. Fight, come for me. Okay. But there are a lot of folks who also are quieter. They're more settled in what's happening with them. Different personality types, right, and how we present. Not everybody feels comfortable, or they don't know they have the privilege and permission to stand up for themselves in those spaces, because we're taught as Black people and Latinx folks mostly that we can't, that you're just supposed to take whatever. You have to work twice as hard to be half as good. And a lot of that means shutting up and just letting it be. No.
Yeah.
But again, I had parents who taught me to, if I get kicked out, it won't be because you just talk to me any old kind of way. And I can accept that. So we have to leave room for people being in a different place in their journey or in how they want to experience their journey and that being okay. But it's our program's responsibility at the end of the day to ensure that there's room for all of us and that it is attuned to the diversity that exists. Black people are not a monolith. Asian folks are not a monolith. Latinx folks, gay folks, trans folks are not a monolith. So it's that bullshit. So, but that's it. But that's how you build community. It's the larger organization and the system in the United States needs to work on their shit. The programs that are rearing us need to get their shit together too. And we have to be accountable to our own growth process and healing process and then doing the work. Because a lot of us don't have the privilege to be like, okay, I don't feel like being Black today. Like, y'all, I'm dark as hell. So y'all can't see me, but I'm dark. And my tits are huge, wide hips. You know, it's just there's parts about me that I could never hide if I ever, ever tried, right? I don't get the privilege to not be a short, big boob, dark-skinned Black chick with no hair. I don't get to not do that. So if you have privilege in a space, then go harder, then do more. Don't always ask me to do, be doing shit. And I don't get that often. I get it from maybe three people that I know, but we came up through the program together, so.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you say, all the kind of like, first off, like naming the performativeness of the APAs, both of them coming out with this sort of messaging and not ways that you are advocating for the population. So like my thing is Black people, we remember, like we've never forgot the harm that you've done in our communities. We don't need you to bring it up in this performative manner on such a huge platform and type out this letter thinking that like, we're going to be like, oh my gosh, thank you for noticing. Oh my gosh, like, thank you for acknowledging it. No, I'm looking for where the action is. Okay, you sell that. Cool. Where's the action? Where's the change? Where's the advocacy? How are you actually going into these communities and atoning for this harm? How are you working with insurance agencies who use the DSM, who require the DSM in order to for people to be able to use their insurance for mental health services? And I want to hear you talk about this, but like one thing to note is just like how problematic the DSM is that wasn't even created by only mental health, you know, therapists. Yeah. It was contributed to by doctors, by psychiatrists, by people who don't even do therapy. Yet this is something that we as therapists have to use to diagnose people. And because of that, since it has to be used, I know, especially for Black and Brown folks, like we go to therapy wanting to know, oh no, how am I being labeled? Because we are so accustomed to labels. It feels like, okay, we're just going to take on this other label. Like we're used to taking labels from the system, right? And so can you talk to me and to us a little bit about the DSM and some of the qualms with it, I guess. Not to say that the DSM is all bad. It is informative. It does have good info in there and it can impact, you know, give you insight and impact the work that you do with folks, but I think we should also understand the context from which it was like developed and created too.
Yeah.
Go ahead and woosah if you need to.
Okay. So, well, shit. All right. So when it comes to the DSM, it's definitely been at the foundation of how people have been discriminated against. Again, homophobia was in there until what? Or no, being gay was in there until 1972 or 73. Mm-hmm. Either way, it was in the DSM-3, but not the DSM-4 or the DSM-4 text revision. And now we're in the DSM-5. It is mostly put together by psychiatrists and medical doctors with a few psychologists. I believe they have included master's level clinicians. There's some nurse practitioners. But again, the primary people who actually use the DSM for its true purpose, which is diagnosing people with mental health related issues, is psychologists and it's master's level mental health professionals, whether they be social work or through clinical or counseling psychology, right? So I'd be really confused when the medical doctors be showing up with opinions about things. Be really confused about that. But also, we don't consult lay people either. And by lay people, I mean community folks. Because you were talking earlier about community building. If I'm going to use something to diagnose folks, I kind of want to consult with them about what this is like. You ever been at a company or at a job where they say, I feel our employees need this? So they start creating all these little programs and little challenges and shit. But I'm like, didn't nobody ask for that? We asked for you to increase our salary. We asked for us to have real PTO. We asked for sick leave to not count against our ability to use our PTO. You never asked us what we wanted as a employee in order to make these services. You just keep doing little shit to make it sound like you're doing something. Sometimes that's how the DSM feels to me too. Instead of working with the community to better understand where maybe we as top-down processors have negatively impacted them, we just keep using that, well, I'm a doctor, so I know better than you mentality to diagnose and treat. But that's also where we've gotten it wrong a lot. Because again, there's been just identity variables get caught up in that. The DSM becomes monolithic, but at the same time, the presentation of symptoms is not the same for everybody. Like, okay, I'm about to mess with BJ. BJ, pop quiz. What does depression look like in Black men compared to white women?
You know what? I wish I could give a visual because like for Black men, it is that be strong, keep showing up, keep doing it. But also like it is OK to express that maybe in a little bit of anger, maybe. But also you have to make sure that anger is controlled or else you are an angry Black man or else you're getting the cops caught on you or you can even die if someone knows that you're and going through something and calls the cops for even just your assistance. For white women, it's talked about. It's to be expected. It is, they automatically know that they have access to therapists who look like them, who understand their experiences and who can provide, you know, tips and tricks to be able to work through that depression. Also, like for Black men, we have to deal with our own our own difficulty accepting that we are allowing something to impact us. And this is a generalization, but like if you come from like a Christian household, you can't call that depression.
You gotta pray on it.
You can't, therapy isn't on the table. It's go talk to pastor. How are you fasting and praying about it? And I mean, that's very specific to my experience, but it does look completely different. And clinicians, if you are not a multicultural clinician, if you are not a multicultural informed clinician, you're going to say that this person, this Black person might be something else more, negatively impactful, rather than the white woman might just be like, oh, this is just adjustment disorder. This is with, you know, mixed mood in there with some anxiety and depression.
Yeah. So I'm going to do the therapist thing. What I'm hearing you say is, so what I'm hearing you say is that with Black men, there's this need for strength. There's this need to be stoic. There's this need to still make it through and make it over because you can't let nobody see you sweat. You can't let these people play you and know that they got to you in the first place. You also got to make sure that you stay hard, right? Like you have to be a man. You have to be masculine, be masked at all times. And that also means that, you know, you take it on the chin and you keep it moving. That also may mean sometimes you get angry, but you know, you wouldn't have to get angry if people would just leave you the hell alone and do X, Y, and Z, right? That also means that if there is a problem, Big Mom probably told you to go to your pastor or your mom or your grandma or your auntie, ask you the last time you'd read 2 Timothy or something like that, right? Like that's that's where the foundation of you getting help and support looks like. So if you do end up in my office, I, as the typical therapist may say, oh, why are you so aggressive? Like you bucking, you talking all the tone, the words you're using, it sounds aggressive, right? So now I got to give you schizophrenia because now you're talking about people are bothering you and talking shit about you and watching. What do you mean? You sound delusional. You sound like you're hallucinating. So that sounds like schizophrenia. You seem aggressive. Oh, so that's impulse control disorder. That's an undiagnosed oppositional conduct disorder in our babies. But if a white woman particularly comes in and she's sad, she's stressed, and she may even be angry, but her anger is because she doesn't have the ability to express herself. And she's just so constricted by her environment that she's just irritable. You know, she's tired, she's fatigued, she's down, and she just doesn't know what her options are. So this is very clear depression. Even though they're experiencing the same thing, the presentation is different. The DSM says to get a diagnosis of depression, you need depressed mood, but no definition on what that is, because it's going to be subjective. Diminished interest or loss of pleasure in activities or anhedonia. Weight changes, sleep changes, psychomotor agitation, just meaning you may be jittery or stuff like that. Fatigue, worthlessness, diminished ability to think, and maybe some suicidal ideation. Where did your definition or my definition of a Black man's presentation fit in there?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Because we aren't thought about in those spaces. But the DSM holistically does not see how diagnoses are just different based on culture, based on gender, based on sexual orientation, based on how all of our identities may mix together and come up with a different little way to look at it. So that's my beef. It's you want us to use a one size fits all model to 8 billion people from 8 billion different ways of living their life. And that just don't be sitting right with me. So when I teach on the DSM in like my advanced psychopath class, I don't even use the old Beers Club theories in that class. By old Beers Club, I mean the old dead white man.
I was like, old Beers. Okay. See.
You know, Freud, Rogers, all of them. Yalom. I have to use critical race theory to get you to understand that, honestly, it's probably not even depression. You're probably seeing PTSD. And that's what you're really seeing. And the depression is, you know, masking the trauma. So I work with them on liberation psychology, which is from Latin America, the Kawa model, which is the Japanese model. So I have to use theories that you don't even learn in grad school that were created by Black and brown people to help them understand how symptoms present across culture, and then we use that to inform how they understand the DSM, because the DSM is not an effective tool for accurate diagnosis for people who have Black, brown, queer, non-Christian, poor identity. It just don't fit us unless you are trained to really understand how to use it. And if the people who came up with it were medical doctors, and psychiatrists who don't do this level of work. Mm-hmm. And I also have a hard time trusting it. It's a systemic issue that will continually fuck with us marginalized folks more than anybody else. I'm sorry. I know that was a really long answer.
No, it wasn't. You said so much. Like, one of the things that really impacted me and what you said too was that even in training clinicians, you get the old beer club only. I did not, you know, honestly, and I can only say this after like being in grad school, you know, 2009 to 2010, taking a leave of absence that took 8 years to return to it. But those 8 years were so pivotal. But one thing that I really struggled with coming back to school was that I recognized the reason that I couldn't be as passionate about this work the first go round was because I didn't see myself in any of these theories that were provided, that were taught to us. So we were told that, like, oh, you're either CBT or you're Rogerian. You can have a sprinkle of existential psychology in there. But like, you get kind of just like pigeonholed into these theories where, I mean, do I seem like a Rogerian therapist that is just not active in therapy and is just like very reflective? I like to get in there and confront some shit. And I didn't hear about relational cultural theory where I could finally see myself, because it married me being able to be not only a therapist, but also an activist and radical about that shit too. Like with how I want to see therapy grow, like RCT allowed me to see that, like, I don't have to have a rubric for how to do this work. BJ, you know how to connect. You come from a community that, if anything, we know how to connect. So you can use that. And like, RCT allowed me to bring like all the parts of myself to therapy that CBT, that, you know, client-centered, you know, even some existential, like, didn't really either demonstrate how to still be yourself and utilize those. But also, like, they didn't provide any supportive theories outside of those big ones. It was all self-study. It was all, oh, if you want to, yeah, you can look this up. And that's how, again, I discovered RCT, polyvagal, which talks about, you know, trauma on a neuropsych level and how it impacts us. Like, this is all knowledge that all clinicians need, that we don't have, because we're being sold on this white dream, the cisette white dream of psychology.
And thank you for saying that, because you're exactly correct. And it even just makes me question program and the field's commitment to true cultural competency. If that's something that's in our ethics codes, but it's not woven, I don't know, BJ, what's the word, child? If it's not mixed in, throughout the entire program, prove to me you really care, right? Like, what's that thing? Your actions speak louder than your words. So again, the letters in December and January from the APAs were cute, but show me how that's actually mattered to you in the work. Have you set up a fund for free therapy for poor Latinx and brown folks? Have you actually worked to ensure that the communities that are under-resourced have mental health clinics that aren't understaffed? When I was in Inglewood, the clinicians that were training me, they had a caseload of about 97 people. 97. BJ, I was a second year. I was a second year practicum student. Guess how many people I had on my caseload?
I hope no more than, and this is even a high number, I hope no more than 30.
47. And because of where I was doing therapy in home and in school because our site wasn't big enough for people to come to the center. So I had to actually drive to people's houses or to their school to see them.
Wow.
Are you guys providing through the APA resources like MetroCards? Are you giving out CTA cards so people can get to therapy? Are you having a whole, you know, segment set up so people can really understand their insurance? Like, you got Psych Today, but people don't know how to use that. And even in Psych Today, if I put in I want a black psychologist, I'm still going to show up a lot of white people because that filter does not work, but actually it works the way they intended to work.
It means like white people who are comfortable, you know, working with black folks.
They put it because they put it in their little blurb, right? I've worked with black Latinx, indigenous, and but again, back to what you were saying about the program, it's just this idea that we aren't comfortable with being uncomfortable, but we expect that of our clients. And that's something that the field is not ready to really address, but whether they are or they aren't, they have maybe, unfortunately for them, but fortunately for me, they've hired people like us. Who was like, well, I ain't ask you what you was ready to do. I said, this is what we're going to do.
Like, if you want to make this work. Impact, this is what you got to do. Do you want to use me, or you just want me here to show up on your website so that you can say we have, you know, black staff?
BJ, how long have I held a job?
You transition out of that quick if it's unfulfilling.
I won't be used, okay? I will be no one's token, all right? But it's just the piece of it where you should not have had to go out of your way to learn RCT. It should have just been embedded in your program, and it shouldn't have just come up in diversity class, which it didn't even come up there. You know? So it's just this idea that you have to hope you just get a faculty member who gives a shit about a lot of that and teaches you different models. But then again, do they even know? But then also I still hold them accountable because you got a doctorate. So you did a dissertation, which means you know how to research. And if you claim to know there's an issue, then you also should know to look into it. Right. Oh, but you didn't.
So you got into this.
Yeah, my bad. That was a little ranty.
Theorize about things that, you know, don't impact people who need it. Like, oh, did you get in this just to have fun with, you know, different research? Or do you actually want to create change? And like, back to the APAs, like, how are y'all funding these sites? Like, how are you advertising these community mental health sites that, one, if you want to make these changes that you recognize in this letter, change that funding. Like, fund more of these community mental health sites, provide more incentives for folks to go to these sites, and make sure that, like, they're able to actually help the communities that they're serving instead of burning out people who want to do this work, but get to the site and realize, oh no, this is like, this room is on fire. I can't stay here. Because that's the other way that it's controlled systemically. It's like, okay, yeah, this is an APA site. This is great, but I'm a student. One of my only cohort, like, and this is theoretical, like, say I'm a student and like one of the only like black students in my cohort. And I'm like, hey, if I want to work with black and brown folks, I got to go to this community mental health space. And then I'm overworked once I'm there. How is this preparing me for the field? How is this setting me up for success? How is this setting my clients up for success? How is this setting the site up for success and in part this community? Because now you have all of these people who have a desire to help and create change, but you have not supported them. But I recognize, you know, our history with you and the harm that we've created and all that. Like, that shit's for the birds. Because show us in money, show us in your investments, show us in your support.
And show the therapist that too, right? Because you talking about us doing all that work, but they're going to pay you with a master's, what, 45, 47? They're going to pay me with a doctorate in those community mental health agents, 55? I got, you know how much I owe in student loans? Like, that 55 ain't doing shit. You know what I mean? But then there's always that push and call. Well, therapists just need to understand the value of their work and it shouldn't cost so much. That's cute, but bitch got bills, okay? And I also like crab legs. I like Tom Ford perfume. You know, it's like I also get to like and have nicer things as well. I put in a lot of work and investment into my education, which had output on the work that I do. And we deserve to get paid. And again, that is an insurance thing too. Insurance companies need to, one, everybody should just have free insurance. But then also insurance companies should be paying out at the max rate and not be nickel and diamond people for their work. And then you can't do any type of good work when you have a caseload of more than 30 people, to tell you the truth, or 35 folks, depending on who you are. It's just not realistic. It's not realistic. So it's hard work. And again, loving the work that we do, but we need to do better and we need to be more accountable and we need to show up instead of the cute little think pieces and articles that come out every 6 months, especially after another Black person was murdered in the street. So do the actual work and stop getting on my damn nerves, because
yeah, we ain't got time. We're trying to heal our communities. We're trying to do this work, even though y'all, you know, say you want us to do this work, but you aren't showing us. Like, we are trying to really commit to our communities to see them grow and to heal in ways that are actually important, not ways that you deem as necessary so that they can like assimilate into society in a way that you want them to be.
Ugh, not assimilate. Ugh.
Yeah. So
no, you're right though. You're right.
Yeah. So also, like, now I'm thinking about it, like treatment plans, like, like that could be a long conversation, but like even the fact of how treatment plans can impact change in Black and Brown folks' lives. Like, if you are a clinician who doesn't understand my culture, doesn't understand me, you cannot give me a treatment plan that's going to be marked as successful.
Honestly, it goes back to what you were saying before when you asked me about community building. Again, and I'm just going to reiterate what BJ said because it was perfect. You cannot give me an effective treatment plan if you don't know anything about my culture. But then again, you don't know anything about my culture because you haven't tried to spend any time with us either. You also haven't invested in people from the culture to be active members in the field later on either. You aren't working with us in elementary school and middle school by coming to those career days they do with the little people, or when your school does a field trip and they take you to IBM when they really could take you to what, Advocate, and they could take you over to Ada McKinley, they could take you over to Kennedy King, like they could take you to these places that embed you in the neighborhood, in the community, so we can see different types of employees, so we can say, oh, I didn't even know therapy was a thing because we don't talk about that. So if you aren't getting us interested in the field early on in the same way that these other people get a chance to, how do we know about it to be embedded? But then also you don't want to pay us shit, but then charge us an arm and a leg to be in these programs. So now we're in debt for a degree that's going to pay us what, maybe 60K cap for a lot of us, 70K cap is the average for a psychologist in the state of Illinois. That ain't nothing compared to the $527,683.92 I owe in student loans, $357 of which was the actual student loan, and the rest is my interest.
Yeah.
And again, BJ will tell you, I wasn't going to the Bahamas. I literally paid for my education, and he's been to my apartments back in the day. I lived in the cheapest, rattiest places I could find because that's what I could afford. I wasn't using my student loans to go on trips. I literally took out what I needed to have a pizza last me for a week. One pizza. I remember that. I remember being on them air mattresses huddled up by the radiator with a large pepperoni pizza and a flip phone and a copy of Hitch. I remember that.
You too.
A bitch can't ever forget that. You know, it's still my movie to this day. Okay. Remember, we're here. Okay, stay right here. This is your lane. Stay right here. Like, that's my shit.
Yeah.
But it's just like, what do they be saying now on the internet? It's just not giving what it was supposed to have gave. And it's just
yeah. I could talk all day about the student loans and the livable wages.
Okay.
I mean, all day. But
you can't treatment plan what you don't know. That's all. That's all we were trying. I know that went all the way left. Yeah. But you can't treatment plan what you don't know. And honestly, if you don't know the community, you can't say, well, go for a walk. Bitch, where? Up 94? Because ain't no parks.
Yeah. And y'all going to pick me up if I'm walking on 90-94.
So. Right. Okay. And then you're going to say that I'm a person that needs to be institutionalized for a hot 72. So please help me understand. Where am I supposed to do self-care and I got 3 jobs and 4 kids? Or I'm taking care of a family member full time because we can't afford the insurance to take them to hospice. When I'm supposed to do that? I got to do a face mask while I hold their arm up during dialysis. I don't think that's what that looked like.
Yeah.
I can't even afford to get to your office for a session. And you want me to just take a day off to relax? What does that mean?
Yeah. I could talk all day about this, but before we do get out of here, I do want you to tell us, well, where can people learn more about you and the work that you're doing. Everybody buckle up, get a notepad out, because you're about to hear all of the things.
Can't stand you, for one.
But yeah, where can people find you? Where can they learn more about you? Where can they also see some of the projects that you're working on? Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Even I had to pull it up on my phone because I don't be knowing all of these things. So I have to fight my urge because BJ knows I just have a tendency to give people my cell phone number. And I need to stop doing that. Okay. So my personal Instagram is just my full long ass name. So Leela Ellis Nelson Psyd. That's LeelaEllisNelsonPsyd. My one podcast is Just a Thought. That's with my homie and brother, Emeka. Excuse me, Dr. Chukwu Emeka Ikeguano. And we interview other Black people who are professionals, who are creators, who are just out here living their best lives, just to learn more about what they do too. So you can follow us on Instagram at justathought_EL. And the podcast is literally anywhere you stream podcasts. Then there's also the one I do with my husband, Will, and one of my other bros, Desmond. That one's called I Got You Pegged. Now, that one's about like dicks and, you know, interviewing some of our favorite adult entertainers of the week and, you know, telling our whole tales and stuff like that. But that's but that one on Instagram is I, as in the letter I, then got you, as in the letter U, pegged, P-E-G-G-E-D. And then, of course, the other one is Coffee Hour. That one is for people who are in the field of mental health or want to be, and maybe you're a student or you're just thinking about it, and you are a member of a community of color, and you're just really trying to figure some shit out. So that one on Instagram is literally Coffee Hour Chicago. I give you the Instagrams because the Instagrams have everything else linked to them. And those are the ones I post the most on anyway. So if you find us on Instagram, you can definitely find our podcast or the next time we're doing meetup. We just had an amazing meetup with soon to be Dr. BJ Rudd a couple months ago where he talked. So you're missing out on really great content. And he's also going to be on Just a Thought as soon as he stops playing these games and gives Emeka his schedule. Oh, yeah, y'all. I'm putting all his little business out here. So I feel like if I tell y'all about it, y'all will get on him and he'll like get it together and hit me up.
Just edit it out. It's okay. Keep going.
Edit it out. But yeah, so you have my personal if you just want to connect to me. Hit me up on Just a Thought if you want to hear that podcast, or I Got You Pegged if you want to listen to that. And then Coffee Hour, if you're trying to be part of this, you know, psych fam, but you also want to go into it being a better, intentional, culturally aware and sensitive person too.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, like, Coffee Hour has been like so fulfilling. I've seen it for so many years. I took a while to like join. I was championing from afar. You know, but when they was meeting in person, I was like, I don't even know if I can make it. I'm flaky anyway. But it's just community building. Like that is, it's so nice to be talking to other Black and Brown folks in this field. And some people outside of the field who just want to like join for the conversation too, as we talk about these different topics, as we talk about how they impact us individually. Again, creating these spaces that schools don't create for us, even though they should. Creating these spaces that jobs don't create for us, even though they should too. And so, yeah, if y'all looking for community out there, definitely connect with Dr. Leela Ellis Nelson Psyd. or connect with me. Like you can email us at blackpeopletherapy@gmail.com. I'm happy to send y'all those links. But also just a big shout out and thank you to Leela for giving us her time and her knowledge and her expertise and just dope-ass attitude about the work that we do.
No, yeah. I'm going to stop you. Thank you for letting me be here and, to, you know, be me and talk shit and always encouraging me over the years and hopping in random vans with random chicks that you just met to go to IKEA and creating lifelong bonds where we have to go buy more plants at IKEA in the next couple of weeks. So, you know, I love you.
We retail bonded.
We were literally just at the plant store 2 days ago.
Well, I'll let you get to your day. For everybody, thank you for listening to our first consultation.
Thanks, y'all.
We hope you enjoyed it. There are more to come. Our plan is going to be to have these probably every three sessions. So we'll be breaking things up from sessions to have a consultation with another Black or Brown person in the mental health field. So hope y'all enjoyed. We look forward to being able to let you know more about the dope people doing dope shit in this industry. And y'all take care of yourselves. Bye-bye. This concludes another session of Black People Go to Therapy Too. I appreciate every single one of y'all who support us and continue to break the stigmas surrounding our mental health journeys and the care that we deserve. Be sure to check us out on Instagram at Black People Therapy, Facebook at Black People Go to Therapy Too, and Twitter at Black PPL Therapy. And are you a person of color with experiences in therapy and a willingness to talk about your mental health journey on the podcast? Great. Check out the episode description for our guest survey, or you can email us at blackpeopletherapy@gmail.com to learn more. Thanks, and be well, y'all.